me your tray. I'll serve them myself. Why? We'll see. Elisabetta accepted the tray and, when the pasta was ready, took it from the boiling water, strained it, and plated it. She scooped the clams onto the pasta, drizzled hot olive oil with garlic over the servings, then tossed each dish and topped them with fresh parsley. She set the plates on the tray and hustled from the kitchen. Baron von Weizsäcker sat at a table with a Nazi officer in uniform. Weizsäcker had on a suit instead of his uniform, as was his habit, though he always wore his Nazi lapel pin. Elisabetta beelined for his table. Good evening, Baron von Weizsäcker. How nice to see you. We're serving one of your favorite dishes tonight.
I heard, Elisabetta. The alle vongole.
Weizsäcker smiled, with nice, even teeth. An Italophile, he had the bearing of a cultured aristocrat, with thinning blondish-gray hair, hooded eyes set close together, a patrician nose and refined lips. Elisabetta placed his meal in front of him. Buon appetito, Baron.
Grazie.
The presentation is wonderful. The parsley looks so fresh. Thank you. I grow our herbs in my garden.
Of course you do. Every detail is perfect.
Weizsäcker gestured to his table mate, a beefy Nazi with a lengthwise scar on his left cheek.
Elisabetta, this is Colonel Kepler.
Pleased to meet you, Colonel Kepler. Elisabetta shuddered inwardly. Kepler was the feared head of the Gestapo, and if he was around, the rumor about the ghetto could likely be true.
Nice to meet you.
Colonel Kepler nodded stiffly. Weizsäcker interjected.
Elisabetta, I've been telling Colonel Kepler that Casa Servano serves the finest food in Rome. Nonna made the best pasta I've ever tasted, and you're a very worthy protege.
Thank you. Buon appetito, Colonel Kepler. Elisabetta reached over the table with the steaming plate, then pretended to trip. The plate flew into the air, flipped over, and landed upside down on Kepler's lap.
Ugh!
Kepler jumped up, grimacing. Hot oil stained his crotch, as if he had urinated on himself, which Elisabetta couldn't have planned if she tried. He brushed spaghetti from his pants, and clamshells clattered to the floor.
Oh, no!
Weizsäcker recoiled. The other diners craned their necks, and a nervous murmur rippled through the restaurant. Elisabetta faked a gasp. Colonel Kepler, I'm so sorry. How clumsy of me.
Elisabetta, get a rag,
Weizsäcker snapped. Yes, sir. Elisabetta escaped to the kitchen. After closing the restaurant, Elisabetta hurried to the ghetto, where she found the piazza in front of the synagogue packed with distraught families hugging each other and talking in groups. Men hustled to and from the synagogue, which was open. Light streamed through its tall windows of stained glass, glowing orange, yellow, green, and blue against the night sky. Elisabetta scanned the crowd for Sandro, but didn't see him. She spotted a young couple in worn brown coats and crossed to them. Excuse me, she said. May I ask, do you know what's going on? I've heard a terrible rumor that the Jews have to raise gold to give to the Nazis.
Yes, it's true,
the wife answered, her forehead knit with fear.
It's a nightmare.
The husband shook his head, his mouth downturned in a thick beard.
Every family is contributing, but few have valuables or money anymore.
I'd like to help. Elisabetta took from her purse an envelope containing the earnings of the day. I don't have gold, but I have money.
How kind of you. You can bring your contribution to the second floor of the synagogue. Ask for a lawyer named Massimo Simone.
Elisabetta hid her reaction. If Sandro's father was there, then Sandro would be too. She would have loved to see him, but she doubted that he wanted to see her. He hadn't contacted her after she had left him the supplì. She handed the man her envelope.
Will you take it in for me instead?
If you wish.
The husband accepted the envelope.
What's your name? I'll tell them you contributed.
No, thank you.
Elisabetta turned away, hurrying from the ghetto.
Chapter 86. Sandro. 28th of September, 1943. Tuesday morning. The deadline was only hours away, and Sandro, his family, Presidents Foa and Almanzi, Angelo Anticoli and his assistants, the accountant Renzo Levi, and the secretary Rosina Sorani were in the Sala di Consiglio, exhausted. They had been collecting gold in dribs and drabs for hours on end. Their hopes had soared and plummeted, but they had made more phone calls, knocked on more doors, and tracked down every member of the community for contributions. They had even bought 15 kilograms of gold with cash they had collected. Now they stood around the table, waiting to see if they had reached their goal. Angelo placed a single earring on the brass scale. The fulcrum squeaked just the slightest. They all held their breath. Angelo straightened, grinning. "We did it!" Everyone cheered. Sandro hugged his father. The women burst into tears, clinging together. Almanzi and Foa shook hands, beaming with joy. Angelo, his assistants, and Renzo clapped each other on the backs. Against all odds, they had succeeded, and faster than anyone had expected. The gold filled 10 boxes on the table, 5 kilograms in each. They even had enough money left over to put 2,021,540 lire in the community safe in the synagogue. Last night, the Vatican had offered to loan them any shortfall, but the community had hoped to rely only on themselves. "Son," Sandro's father released him, his eyes glistening behind his glasses. "Well done."
"You too, Papa."
Foa cleared his throat.
"I thank all of you for your Herculean efforts. We did this together. It is a tribute to the love, strength, and power of our community."
Almanzi nodded.
"I will call the Vatican and thank the Pope, but I am extremely proud that we did not fall short. That said, we still have time, so I would delay before we announce our wonderful news to the community. As much as I want to relieve their suffering, I think we should keep up the collections to be on the safe side. I also think we should call Colonel Kepler and ask for an extension. I don't want him to think we met his deadline too easily."
"Very wise."
Foa turned to Sandro's father. "Massimo, do you agree?"
"Yes, on all points. If we tell the Nazis we met their demand, they'll just ask for more and put us back where we started."
His father turned to Sandro. "Son, what do you think?"
"I agree," Sandro answered, pleased to be asked.
The Nazis ended up extending the deadline, and when it was time, Foa, Almanzi, and Massimo traveled to Villa Wolkonski with the gold. For some reason, Kepler wasn't there, and they were redirected to his office at Via Tasso, an unwelcome turn of events. At first, the Nazis claimed the gold was of insufficient weight, but after protest, they reweighed the amount and had to relent. The Jews of Rome were saved. Chapter 87. Marco, 29th of September, 1943. It was just before dawn, and the vast sky in the countryside was a warm golden orange at the horizon, cooling to sheer blue as it thinned to atmosphere. The moon was only the slimmest of crescents, barely a curved white line, like the obverse image of a shadow. Marco, his father, and the partisans had just assumed their firing positions, propped up on their elbows and lying belly down along the deserted dirt road with a steep hill. They were waiting to ambush a Nazi convoy due to pass in half an hour. Marco looked down the sight of his long gun, which he aimed at the crest of the hill. His father had learned of the convoy late last night, so the partisans had mobilized quickly. They lay hidden by a hillock that bordered the road, and behind them was an abandoned lemon grove. Rotting lemons soured the air. Bees droned around Marco's head. His father looked over next to him.
Marco, when it starts, keep your head down.
Who are you more afraid of, the Nazis or Mamma?
Do you have to ask?
His father smiled. Marco felt closer to his father than ever.
Papa, you'll be safe too.
I survived Caporetto. I can survive anything.
Marco was surprised, as his father never said the word Caporetto out loud.
Get ready.
His father took aim. They're coming.
How do you know?
I feel the vibration within my chest.
Marco fell silent and felt the telltale vibration. Not long after, the mechanical rumble of heavy engines came from the far side of the hill, a steep grade. The convoy was said to consist of 3 covered trucks carrying supplies, escorted by 2 VW Kubelwagens, one in front and one behind. The gears ground as the trucks labored up the incline on the far side. Marco tensed, readjusting his aim. The engine sound intensified, and he waited for the order to fire. It would come from his father. The battle plan was for the partisans to hold fire until the entire convoy was on the downward slope of the hill. Marco looked down the barrel and reminded himself to be patient. In the next moment, a Kubelwagen crested the hill. Marco swallowed hard, keeping his head low. There were 4 Nazi soldiers in the Kubelwagen. It descended the hill, picking up speed. Marco felt his heart hammer. A truck crested the hill with 2 Nazi soldiers in the cab. It followed the Kubelwagen closely. The second truck crested the hill, then the third. Marco's mouth went dry. Another Kubelwagen containing Nazi soldiers crested the hill. The entire convoy was moving fast on the long downward slope. All of a sudden, the partisans near the bottom of the hill threw a slew of quattropunti onto the road. The Nazi vehicles had too much momentum to stop. The first Kubelwagen hit the quattropunti. Its tires popped and began to deflate.
Fire!
Shouted his father. Marco and the partisans started shooting. The Nazis in the Kubelwagen were caught unawares, shot as they reached for their weapons. The first truck crashed into the Kubelwagen, too heavy to stop. The second truck joined the pileup. The third truck tried to drive off the road. Hillocks blocked them on both sides. The driver of the second Kubelwagen tried to veer out of the way. Momentum carried him downward into the pileup. The partisans rained bullets on the convoy. Smoke filled the air. Nazis returned fire, but fell under the barrage. Marco and the partisans kept firing. The Nazis jumped from the trucks only to be cut down. In time, no Nazis were firing back.
Ceasefire!
His father shouted, signaling. Marco and the partisans stopped shooting. One of the partisans had gotten hit in the hand, but they hadn't lost a single man. The battle was over. Marco felt adrenaline ebb from his body, leaving him shaking. He eased to the ground and set down his gun. He scanned the carnage. The quattropunti had done their job. The partisans had won. His father sat down beside him, putting an arm around him. Neither said a word. The partisans ran down to the road, climbing into the covered trucks to see what supplies they held. Nazis lay dead and dying, their bodies in horrifying positions. Their sightless eyes stared at the sky. Their Wehrmacht uniforms had gone black with blood. Smoke wafted above the carnage, and the odor of cordite overpowered the citrus smell. Marco couldn't tear his eyes from the gruesome scene. This battle was different from Porta San Paolo. Here he was close to the soldiers he had killed. He could see their faces, and they were young men like him. Not long ago they had been his allies, his friends, Rolf. Marco felt despair despite the victory. He had believed in fascism, and they had believed in Nazism. Yet he was alive, and they were dead. There was no difference between him and them. They were all young men who believed in the wrong thing. Marco prayed This was the last war. But he knew it wouldn't be. Men were fallible, and they would always believe in the wrong things. He sensed that he had just learned something that his father had already known, but neither of them spoke. The sun began to rise, sending golden rays between the cypresses and lemon trees. Father and son turned instinctively to watch the sunrise. Marco kept his eyes on the sun until they hurt.
Chapter 88. Elisabetta, 29th of September, 1943. Elisabetta hurried to work. She hadn't slept for worrying about Sandro. The newspapers contained no news of the Nazi demand for gold, nor did the radio offer anything. She had already asked two men on the street if they knew whether the ghetto had come up with the gold. Neither had any idea what she was talking about. She spotted a little old man walking, wearing a dark suit and a cappellino, a skull cap. She caught up with him, touching his elbow.
"Excuse me, sir. May I ask you a question?"
"Of course, young lady."
"Do you know if the ghetto was able to come up with the gold?"
"Yes," he answered, a smile creasing his lined face. "We did."
"Thank God."
Elisabetta threw her arms around him. He didn't seem to mind.
Chapter 89. Sandro. 29th of September, 1943. Tonight was the eve of Rosh Hashanah, and Sandro and his father were in the synagogue early in the morning, putting the Sala di Consiglio back in order with his secretary, Rosina. Sandro felt happy and proud that the ghetto Jews had survived their ordeal. He had never admired his father more, having seen him rise to the challenge. Suddenly, the grinding of heavy engines came from the piazza. Sandro exchanged glances with his father, and Rosina's eyes flared in alarm. The three of them hurried to the window and looked outside in horror. Panzer tanks with long tank guns were driving to the very doors of the synagogue. Behind them were Kubelwagens full of Nazis and two large covered trucks. Rosina emitted a frightened cry.
"Oh no!"
Sandro felt a bolt of terror.
"What are they doing?"
his father asked, clutching the windowsill. They watched as Nazis in Wehrmacht uniforms jumped out of the vehicles, unloaded sawhorses from the truck, and cordoned off the piazza. A black sedan with Nazi flags pulled up, and a Gestapo captain emerged from its back seat with a plainly nervous President Foix. Families in the piazza began to gather behind the cordon.
"Let's go."
His father led the way, and they hurried downstairs, reached the ground floor, and met Foix and the Gestapo officer as they entered the synagogue. Foix gestured to the Nazi, tense.
"This is Captain Meyer of the SS. Captain Meyer, allow me to introduce—"
"I have no time for chit-chat,"
Meyer interrupted him, unsmiling.
"We need to search the synagogue for radio equipment. We believe that you Jews have been in secret contact with the Badoglio government."
Foix added,
"Captain Meyer's men searched my house this morning, looking for such evidence. Of course, he found none. I assured him that none of us has any such contacts."
"Of course not."
Sandro's father turned to Meyer.
"There is no reason to search the synagogue. This is a place of worship. There is no radio equipment here or anything of the sort. This is outrageous."
Sandro bit his tongue, frightened for his father. Nazi soldiers armed with submachine guns were already pouring through the door, positioning themselves behind Meyer in a show of lethal force.
"Stand aside,"
Meyer said to them, then barked an order in German. The Nazi soldiers aimed their guns at Sandro, his father, and Rosina. His father straightened.
"Captain Meyer, you need not threaten us in this way. I merely sought to explain. Move aside."
They did so, and Meyer issued another order, causing the Nazi soldiers to lower their weapons. On the next command, the Nazis flooded the sanctuary, jogged down the aisles in their black boots, and rifled through the carved wooden seats. There were locked wooden boxes at each seat that contained prayer books, and they smashed the lids with the butts of their guns. Sandro and the others watched, terrified and aghast. One cadre of Nazis hustled to the alms boxes, also locked, and broke them open the same way. Yet another cadre hurried to the front of the synagogue, climbed the steps to the bima, and headed for the ark, which held the sacred Torah scrolls and other holy books behind a brocade curtain. Sandro clutched his father's arm, and they stood in stunned disbelief as the Nazis yanked the curtain aside, exposing the holy books. They picked up two scrolls and threw them on the floor, a profanity. Sandro's father gasped,
"Captain Meyer, that's vandalism. Those soldiers are in a sacred area where only rabbis are permitted. There is no radio equipment."
Fouad's eyes rounded with alarm.
"Captain Meyer, you can't do this. This is a violation of Jewish law, and I cannot sanction silence."
Meyer shouted,
"I have orders to search the synagogue from top to bottom. You lost the oar and are now under martial law. Quiet, or I'll have you taken to Via Tasso."
Sandro's heart hammered in his chest, and he looked over, horrified to see Nazis swarming the stairwell, running upstairs and down.
"Now, we go upstairs, everyone."
Meyer gestured to the stairwell, and Sandro and the others followed him and ascended to the second floor, only to be greeted by an appalling sight. Nazis were ransacking the bookshelves in the conference room, tossing books and papers onto the floor. One side of the room held locked file cabinets, and Nazis broke them open and rifled through the contents. Other Nazis arrived with cardboard boxes and started packing the papers and files. Sandro's father frowned.
"Captain Meyer, those are records of the community. Why are they being confiscated? You said you wanted only to search."
"We can search more effectively off the premises."
Meyer pointed at the bookshelf against the far wall.
"Foa, what are those bound volumes?"
Foa hesitated.
"The minutes of our meetings of the Jewish Council and financial ledgers."
Meyer gave orders in rapid German, and Nazis tore the volumes and financial ledgers from the shelves and loaded them into boxes.
"Foa, what are those index cards?"
Foa's lined face fell.
"The names, addresses, and genealogy information of our members."
Meyer gave more orders, and Nazis began boxing the index cards.
"Foa, I know the community has a safe. Where is it?"
Foa sighed in resignation.
"In my office."
"Show me. Signora, remain here, please. The others, come with me."
Foa crossed to his office and opened the door, followed by Sandro and his father. The room contained a desk covered with papers, a wooden cabinet, and a bookshelf filled with books, photographs, and a menorah of engraved silver. Sandro had never been in the office before. Foa opened the cabinet door, revealing a black safe.
"Here, open it." "The key's in my desk."
Foa pulled out his desk drawer, produced a small gold key, then unlocked the safe. Meyer looked inside.
"How much money is that?"
"About 2 million lira.
"Leave, I must use the telephone."
Meyer motioned them out and closed the door while they waited in coerced silence. Sandro exchanged looks with his father, who looked angrier than he had ever seen him. Around them, Nazis ransacked cabinets and confiscated files, papers, and index cards. Sandro strained to eavesdrop on Meyer's phone call, but couldn't make out the German words. After a few minutes, Meyer opened the door and gestured to the safe.
"Foa, I have new orders from Colonel Kepler to seize that money. Get a small box and pack it up for me."
"But it's ours."
Foa's lips parted in dismay.
"We collected it in response to his demand for gold."
Sandro's father interjected.
"Captain Meyer, you have no legal basis for taking community property. You called it a seizure, but it's common robbery, a criminal act."
Meyer glared at him.
"Such defiance. I'll report you to Colonel Kepler, Simone."
Sandro cringed, terrified for his father.
"Captain Meyer," he blurted out, "my father is a lawyer, and he's only trying to protect the community."
"Captain Meyer, please, I'll comply."
Foa quickly picked up a box of correspondence from his desk, but Meyer grabbed it from him and dumped the letters on the rug.
"Get out, we'll do it."
Meyer motioned them out again, and they stood aside as he barked orders to his soldiers, who fetched more boxes and began emptying the contents of Foy's office. As the morning wore on, Captain Meyer and the Nazi soldiers loaded the community's papers, files, minutes books, financial ledgers, and other property onto the covered trucks in the piazza. Sandro, his father, Foa, Rosina, and families on the piazza, among them Sandro's mother and Rosa, watched in horrified silence. It struck him that tonight was Rosh Hashanah, and the Jewish New Year, 5704. He had hoped things would be better. Now he feared they would be worse. Later, Sandro huddled with his parents and Rosa around the kitchen table, having finished a meager lunch of spaghetti with diluted pomodoro sauce. Sandro felt disturbed after seeing the Nazis vandalize his synagogue, a sacred house of worship. He hated that there was nothing anyone could do to stop the Nazis in any way. If the fascists had ruined the ghetto Jews, the Nazis intended to destroy them. Rosa shook her head. I have to say, after seeing those tanks, I'm frightened for our lives, truly. We should go into hiding. We know people who can help us, like Emedio and Monsignor Flaherty.
You think so? Sandro asked, uncertain.
Yes, absolutely. Others have, even Chief Rabbi Zolli. Why don't we? This could be our last chance.
Well, Sandro's father sighed, his expression gravely troubled. I admit what I saw today opened my eyes. The Nazis enjoyed vandalizing the synagogue. That excuse about the radio was a pretext to terrorize us and steal from us. Greed fueled them, but so did hatred. I always thought that we'd be safe in Rome, but I never anticipated that the Nazis would occupy us. I'm sorry. I should have.
His father glanced at his mother, then back at Sandro and Rosa.
You two should know that your mother and I have been talking. We think it would be prudent for both of you to go into hiding.
What?
Rosa recoiled.
What about you and Mamma?
We're staying here. We place our faith in God.
Sandro shook his head. We won't go without you. His mother touched Sandro's hand.
You can and you must. I can't go, and your father feels the same way. But we don't want to take further risks with you two.
Rosa touched her hand.
Mamma, you'll both be trapped here.
We're not trapped here. We're needed here. I'm the only obstetrician in the ghetto, and you know that many of my deliveries are complicated these days by malnutrition and illness. I have a patient who will go into labor any day now, Cecilia from around the corner. It's her first child, and she's been sick with pneumonia. I can't abandon her.
Rosa frowned.
But after her, can't you go then?
No, there'll be Regina and Clara. They're both in their 9th month. There are simply too many women here who need me.
Sandro turned to his father.
Papa, you too?
I'll stay with your mother.
His father managed a smile, rallying.
I can't turn my back when everyone is most in need. So many Jews in the ghetto lack our advantages. They couldn't go into hiding even if they wanted to. They look up to me now. I'll stay to help Foa and the others.
Then we'll stay too.
Rosa interrupted him, sounding as determined to stay as she had been to go. Sandro understood her change of heart.
Yes, we all stay.
His father's gaze met his own.
Son, are you sure?
Yes.
Sandro hadn't known that he felt this way until this very moment.
We're ghetto Jews. This is where we belong, with our community.
His father held out his hand, palm up.
Then let us pray.
Chapter 90. Sandro, 30th of September, 1943. Sandro, his father, and President Foa stood in the sanctuary while carpenters fixed the lockboxes, seamstresses repaired the curtain, and cleaners mopped the floor. The Nazis had done significant damage, and Sandro had spent the morning trying to find whatever ledgers still existed, then figuring out how the community would pay for the restoration, given that the Nazis had also stolen their money. Sandro startled at the sudden sound of cars driving up to the synagogue on the piazza. He, his father, and Foa turned to the open doors, and the workers stopped abruptly. Everyone stiffened to see Nazis pulling up in a line of Kubelwagens. Foa shook his head.
What do they want now?
Sandro's father answered.
My guess is anything of value. The libraries, the Argenteria.
Sandro turned to his father. Can't we stop them, Papa?
We can try.
His father led the way, and they hurried down the aisle, meeting two Nazi captains entering the synagogue ahead of armed soldiers. The captains were both bespectacled, reedy, and unarmed, and though they wore Wehrmacht uniforms, they didn't appear to be fighting men. Sandro detected in them a scholarly air, like the professors he had met at La Sapienza. His father met them, but did not extend a hand.
Gentlemen, I am Massimo Simone, and this is President Foa, and my son Sandro. What is the reason for your visit today?
The taller Nazi captain pursed thin lips.
We're from the IAA, the Eisenstab Reichsleiter Rosenberg, a Wehrmacht division responsible for cultural artifacts and rare books. We are Orientalists, and I myself am a professor of Hebrew language studies at the Hochschule in Berlin. We understand you have two very important libraries here, the Biblioteca della Comunità and the Biblioteca del Collegio Rabbinico Italiano. We wish to browse the collections.
For what reason?
For our academic interest.
His father shook his head.
That's not possible. The libraries are private and secure. Show us the libraries.
The Nazi captain gestured to the soldiers behind him.
Force is possible should you refuse.
If you insist,
Sandro's father said pointedly.
Foa added, you must follow proper procedures in handling these artifacts.
The Nazi captain sniffed as if insulted. We are familiar with procedures for handling such items. We brought cloth gloves.
Foa, Massimo, and Sandro led the Nazi captains and soldiers upstairs two flights. And they reached the third floor, where Sandro had never been before, as it was off limits. The stairwell emptied into a small conference room containing a round mahogany table and chairs. Beyond that was a large room with a wall that had glass in its upper half, so that Sandro could see inside. It was more akin to a rare book room than a library, lined with full bookshelves and document cabinets, with greenish shades over the windows to filter out sunlight. Foa headed to the library.
As I say, you must be careful handling. Let me confirm the salient facts,
the taller Nazi interrupted as they walked.
In terms of value, it is our understanding that the Biblioteca della Comunità is one of the most important collections in Europe. It is said to contain rare texts, illustrated scrolls, and manuscripts from the days of the Caesars, and original drawings from the earliest popes. Is that true?
Yes, Foa admitted reluctantly as they reached the library.
Is it also true that, taken together, the collections represent artifacts in history of early Judaism and early Christianity?
Yes, Foa sighed, taking a keyring from his pocket.
Where are the catalogues of these treasures?
Foa pointed through the glass.
On the bookshelf at the left, though we haven't catalogued everything yet. We'll be confiscating the catalogues.
What?
Foa recoiled. Sandro's father interjected.
But you said you wished only to browse. You may not confiscate any of the collection.
The catalogues are not part of the collection per se. They are essentially indices made by you. We wish to enter the library now. You stay here.
The two Nazis entered the library, then closed the door behind them. Sandro, his father, and Foa stood on their side of the glass watching. One Nazi crossed to the catalogues, and the other began scrutinizing the books. Sandro hated feeling so helpless, and he could see his father fuming, his thin skin mottled with emotion, and his gaze trained on the Nazi captains.
This is a disaster, Foa moaned. We need to stop them from sacking the library. They'll ship everything to Germany. The plunder of such precious articles will be a loss for Italian Jewry and Italian culture forever. It's our patrimony.
Sandro's father nodded.
We'll fight back.
using the full force of the law. I can prepare papers to file today, enjoining the ERR in court from any confiscatory action. I will courier an authorizing letter to Almansi for his signature, as only the Union has the authority to administer these libraries.
Foa nodded.
We need allies, so I would courier a letter to the Vatican too. They should want to keep the collections in Rome. The Questura and the Badoglio government should have the same interest.
Sandro interjected. We can even call La Sapienza and other academic institutions. All of them should want to keep the collection in Rome. It has enormous educational value.
Right.
Foa looked encouraged.
When do we start?
In unison, Sandro and his father answered,
Now.
Chapter 91. Marco. 6th of October, 1943. Marco had an errand to run for his boss and hurried down the sidewalk. He turned the corner, but was stopped by a large crowd blocking the sidewalk. They seemed to be watching something going on across the street, their backs to him. Their mood was grim, and they massed on the sidewalk and spilled into the street. Traffic had been detoured, which was highly unusual in this busy district. Marco knew something was wrong. On the other side of the street was the headquarters of the Carabinieri, Rome's military police. He hustled around the crowd and got a clear view of a horrifying sight. Nazi soldiers surrounded the entrance to Carabinieri headquarters, perhaps 100 of them. A long line of covered trucks, maybe 15, idled in front of the building and down several blocks, escorted by Kubelwagens. Nazis guarded the vehicles and the sawhorses, cordoning off the headquarters. Marco watched, shocked, as in the next moment, a cadre of Nazis emerged from the building with 30 carabinieri in handcuffs. He didn't know what was going on. He couldn't imagine that the carabinieri had done anything wrong. An angry murmur rumbled through the crowd, and many cursed the Nazis or made obscene hand gestures at them. The Nazis loaded the carabinieri into the back of a covered truck. Marco kept watching, appalled to see another cadre of Nazis leaving the building with more carabinieri under arrest. The Nazis loaded the second group of carabinieri into another covered truck, and then followed with another group and another in waves of arrests. As soon as one group of carabinieri was loaded, the truck drove off, and another group would be brought out, loaded, and taken away in custody. Marco realized with horror that the Nazis were arresting the entire police force. The very thought had been inconceivable until now. This was a major operation in the center of Rome, but the Nazis had pulled off a total surprise. He hadn't heard a whisper about it at Palazzo Venezia. The partisans didn't know about it either. Marco felt terrified for the city he loved, and for his fellow Romans, who would be utterly defenseless against the Nazis from now on. The crowd watched in fear, their hands to their mouths. Some cursed or wept, and others turned away despairing. Marco stopped counting at 500 carabinieri arrested. He doubted many were left inside, if any. He raced home to tell his father. Chapter 92. Sandro. 13th of October, 1943. Sandro stood with his mother, Rosa, and the other distraught families behind a barricade that had been erected by the Nazis around the piazza. Armed Nazi soldiers guarded the entrance to the synagogue, in a terrifying display of lethal force. The Nazis were about to confiscate the contents of the Biblioteca della Comunità and the Biblioteca del Collegio Rabbinico Italiano, some 10,000 priceless books and artifacts. Legal opposition to prevent the plunder had been to no avail, for the Nazis were beyond the reach of any law, nor had any institution intervened, neither the Vatican, the Badoglio government, the Questura, nor La Sapienza. Sandro's father was inside the synagogue with Presidents Foa and Almansi, in a last-ditch effort to stop the Nazis. Sandro knew it would be futile. His only consolation was that his father and the others had taken matters into their own hands in the past few days, having anticipated that legal methods would fail. They had hidden some of the most precious artifacts from the collection in the homes and gardens of sympathetic families throughout Rome. They had even drained the mikveh, or ritual bath, in the synagogue, and hired a tile setter to hide artifacts in its walls. But this morning, without warning, the ghetto had awakened to find two massive freight cars parked across from the synagogue on the Lungo Tevere de Cenci, on the tracks of the Circolare Nera trolley line. Armed Nazis guarded another barricade around the freight train and detoured traffic away from the typically bustling boulevard. The insignia on the train was the emblem of the German National Railroad, so everyone knew where the train had come from and where it was going. The Nazis had hired Otto and Rossini, an international shipping company, to transport the collection to Germany, and their O&R workmen were inside the synagogue packing. Sandro's father emerged from the synagogue and crossed the piazza. He held his head high as he passed the Nazi soldiers, and if he was afraid, he didn't let it show. Sandro felt a rush of admiration for him. He had seen his father grow in stature during these dark days, and the community had come to regard him as a leader. His father approached the barricade, his expression somber, and the families surged against the cordon, shouting questions at him.
Massimo, how can they take our libraries? They belong to the community. We paid the gold. How much more can they take from us? Were you able to stop this? It's a crime in broad daylight.
Sandro's father motioned for calm.
Friends, I have disappointing news. We could not stop this confiscation, though we tried our very best.
He paused as the families reacted with groans and murmurs. Then he resumed.
However, we have warned them that we will take legal action if any of our artifacts are sold off after they are out of the country. The Germans assure us that they have no intention of doing that. In addition, we have formally requested return of the artifacts after the war.
The families burst into chatter, interrupting him, when an O&R man in a worksuit emerged from the synagogue carrying a box. He was followed by another O&R man with a box, then another. The workmen walked to the freight train, toting fragile books and centuries-old manuscripts in boxes as if they were common pots and pans. Suddenly a book flew from an open window on the upper floor of the synagogue. The book opened in midair, and its ancient pages flapped like a flightless bird. Sandro's father whirled around, crying out,
"No, it will break!"
Sandro gasped as his father ran toward the synagogue, raising his arms. Amazingly, his father caught the book on the fly. The families cheered, clapping. Inexplicably, the Nazis threw another priceless book out of a different window. Sandro's father turned around and scrambled to catch that book too. He did so in the nick of time, right before it hit the cobblestones. Just then another book flew from yet a different window. The family's cheers began to fade, as the Nazis kept throwing priceless books out of the windows, faster and faster. His father ran back and forth in his suit, his tie flying. He tried in vain to catch all of the books, but it was impossible. In no time, it was raining rare books. His father struggled to hold the books he'd already caught, almost tripping.
"Papa, stop!"
Sandro looked on, dismayed. The Nazis were playing a humiliating game. The families reacted with angry shouting. The Nazi guards brandished their guns at the families. The situation turned dangerously volatile. He had to do something.
"Sir,"
Sandro called to a Nazi,
"let me get my father, will you?"
"Go,"
the Nazi scowled, motioning with his long gun. Sandro ducked under the barricade, hurried to his father, and took some of the books from him.
"Papa, stop.
These books are hundreds of years old,"
his father said, anguished and out of breath, his glasses awry.
"Stop now."
Sandro and his father gave the books to an O.R. man who came over with a box. The Nazis kept tossing books out of the windows. Pages came loose, sailed through the air, and fluttered to the ground like trash. Sandro took his father's arm, and they hustled back to the barricade. All around them, precious books plummeted to the piazza and broke on the cobblestones, their spines coming unglued. The crowd rushed the barricade, trying to pick up the pages. The Nazis shouted in German, aiming their guns at the families. The families quieted in fear, weeping and praying. Sandro hurried his father under the barricade, where his mother and Rosa clucked over him, riding his glasses. His father recovered his composure quickly, and the families surged to him, asking him questions again. Sandro spotted a young woman at the far side of the crowd with her head turned away. Her dark curls gleamed in the sunshine, and she had on a pretty blue-checked dress, like Elisabetta used to wear. His heart leapt to his throat, and he found himself threading his way to her. "Elisabetta?" Sandro said, but when the woman turned to face him, she wasn't Elisabetta at all.
"Excuse me? I'm sorry, I thought you were someone else."
Sandro edged backward into the crowd. He should have known better. He had thrown Elisabetta away, and she probably never thought of him. Her love for him was a thing of the past. He remembered that night at La Sapienza, how they had kissed under the stars. He found himself wondering if she had ever written the book she'd wanted to. Sandro made his way toward his family, trying to forget her. Chapter 93. Sandro, 15th of October, 1943. Sandro stood beside Rosa's bed, worried about his sister. She had been sick for over a week, her stomach hurting. She could barely keep anything down. Her pretty face was drawn and pale, and her eyes had lost their shine. His mother rested her palm on Rosa's forehead.
"Darling, your fever is too high. I think we need to get you to the hospital while you can still walk." "I'll be fine," Rosa said weakly. "No, you need treatment."
Sandro agreed with his mother.
"Mama, what do you think is the matter?"
"I can't diagnose her properly without testing. It could be so many things."
"What should we do? Papa won't be home until late."
Sandro had left his father at the synagogue, getting things in order after the sacking of the library.
"You and I can take her. I don't want to wait for Papa. We'll leave him a note."
His mother straightened, her mouth set with purpose. Sandro nodded.
"Good, let's go." "Mamma, no."
Rosa shook her head.
"I don't need to go, and it's after curfew. Sandro, tell her no. The curfew."
"Don't worry. If they stop us, we'll explain that it's a medical emergency."
"Assuming they care," his mother muttered.
Sandro sat with his mother in the waiting area while Rosa was being examined. Dr. Salvatore Cristabello, one of his mother's former colleagues, had been delighted to see her again, though he had done a discreet double take at her shabby brown dress and the change in her appearance. Sandro realized that his mother had gone from slender to gaunt, and when he caught sight of his reflection in a glass window, he saw that he had too. Dr. Cristabello emerged from the door, professional in his crisp white coat with sparse gray hair and thick bifocals. He had a warm, friendly face, but his expression looked grave as he walked toward them.
"How is she?"
His mother rose to meet him, followed by Sandro.
"She'll be fine. And her vitals are good, but I'm going to admit her. I believe it's gastrointestinal, a parasite or the like. We're seeing a lot of that, considering the contamination of the food supply."
"I was thinking the same thing."
"We're giving her fluids and testing blood and urine. It will take a while to get the results back. You should go home and get some sleep."
"I'd like to stay over, if I may."
"Fine. I think I can sneak you in."
"Thank you, Salvatore."
His mother turned to Sandro, touching his arm.
"Go home, dear. Keep your father company."
"But I want to stay too. We left him a note."
Dr. Cristabello interjected.
Sandro, I can pull a few strings to get her into your sister's room, but not you two.
Okay, Sandro agreed reluctantly. Good boy, his mother said, kissing him on the cheek. Sandro left the hospital, and the Ponte Cesti was only steps away, leading to Trastevere and Elisabetta. A powerful wave of emotion swept over him, and he yearned for her. He couldn't fathom how he had lived this long without her. Sandro couldn't deny himself for another minute. His heart led the way, and he turned right over the Ponte Cestio, crossing the bridge and entering a Trastevere he barely recognized. The streets were deserted, and restaurants and shops permanently closed. The windows in the houses were dark, blacked out in case of an air raid. Trash and rubble lay on the streets, and flower pots lay in shards. Trellises went unplanted, and their broken slats clung to walls. A bower of ivy hung overhead, a sole survivor that needed no care, and therefore got none. Like him. Sandro walked as if in a fever dream, his steps leading him to the woman he loved. He would beg her to take him in and shelter him, and he would hold her close, and they would be together, finally, the way they were meant to be, the way God intended before man intervened, and fascists and Nazis and hate and laws and injustice. He drew closer to her house and kept walking, praying that somehow his dream would come true and he would finally be with her. Sandro turned onto her street, and not a soul was in sight. He reached her house, a two-story sliver of gold stucco that radiated like sunshine. The lights were off and the shutters closed. Elisabetta had to be asleep. He thought of Marco serenading her, but Sandro couldn't sing. He had no song. He had nothing anymore. Despair swept over him, and he realized he had no future to offer her. No accomplishments, no alleged genius, not even a healthy body. And he felt flayed to his very bone, nothing but his rawest self longing for her. Sandro collapsed to his knees, landing on the cobblestones. He slumped over, his head down, and the tears he'd held back burned his eyes. He doubled over, breaking down, incapable of anything but sorrow. Sandro? Sandro could have sworn he heard Elisabetta calling his name. It was a voice he had loved for so long and had emanated from far above the street, perhaps from heaven itself. He must have been hallucinating, truly descending into madness. Nevertheless, he looked up.
Chapter 94. Elisabetta. 15th of October, 1943. Just before bedtime, Elisabetta went to the rooftop with the cats, holding a candle in a jar for light. It had rained while she was at work, which presented a problem for the flowers in the terrines, as they had no drainage. She had to drain them, for she couldn't let water rot the roots. It was probably one of the reasons that priceless soup tureens weren't used for planting. She set the lamp on the table and went about her chore, tilting each tureen and letting the water run out onto the roof. Gnocchi and Rico picked their way from pot to pot, mincing on delicate paws to avoid the puddles. Their noses took in the various smells, giving them information only they received, since animals had abilities that far exceeded humans, especially cats, and especially Gnocchi and Rico, who were geniuses even among their own. Elisabetta reached the Capodimonte terrain, then noticed that Gnocchi was heading toward the narrow ledge surrounding the roof. Elisabetta worried whenever the cats walked on the ledge, as she feared they could fall. Gnocchi, please get down, Elisabetta said. But Gnocchi wasn't about to stop what she was doing, even something so dangerous. That was how strong was Gnocchi's will and her self-confidence. Elisabetta approached the ledge cautiously, not wanting to provoke the very disaster she was trying to prevent. She knelt at the ledge, extending her hand, but Gnocchi only turned away, showing her furry di dietro, as she could be cheeky that way. Elisabetta looked over the ledge, taken aback to see a man standing in front of the house. He was tall and thin, and his hair was light enough to catch the moonshine. Something inside her recognized him instantly, despite the darkness. She wondered if it was really him, or if she was in some strange sort of waking dream. It made no sense that he would be in front of her house in the middle of the night. In the next moment, the man fell to his knees. Elisabetta gasped. Sandro! The man looked up, and it was him.
Elisabetta! Sandro rose, looking up. Is that really you?
Yes. Is it really you?
Where are you? Why are you up there?
Why are you down there? Elisabetta shouted, excited. Come up and see me. Go two houses down and around the back. There's an alley.
I'll be right up. Sandro ran off.
Elisabetta jumped to her feet, hurried across the roof, and reached the landing of the fire escape. A few minutes later, Sandro came running down the alley, a silhouette racing toward her, and she felt her heart surrendering to the love she had felt for him for so long.
I love you, Sandro called to her.
I love you too. Elisabetta felt her heart flood with happiness, and Sandro reached the fire escape, grabbed the bottom, and climbed onto the lowest landing. He bounded up the steps, and Elisabetta reached for him just as he swept her up in his arms, lifting her off the stairs, swinging her onto the rooftop, and kissing her once, then again. Elisabetta kissed him back, ardently, fully, embracing him. His arms enveloped her, and all of the heartache and fear and worry melted away, and she felt sheer joy in his embrace. And in the next moment, he set her back on her feet, looked down at her with a smile, and cupped her face in his hands as if she were something precious, as delicate as antique china.
I've missed you so much, Elisabetta.
I've worried so much about you.
We're alive, and I think the worst is over.
Thank God, Elisabetta said quickly, as if they couldn't catch up fast enough.
Did you hear about the gold?
Yes, I was there. I gave money.
You gave? Why didn't you tell me?
And the supplì. Did you like the supplì?
What supplì? What are you talking about?
Sandro stroked her cheek.
I'm so glad you're here. I can't believe you're really here. On the roof of all places.
He looked around, marveling.
What is this place? It smells so wonderful. What have you got up here? Flowers? Plants? I smell basil.
I grow herbs.
Peppers. Tomatoes.
Food. Sandro released her and turned to the tomato plants. He grabbed a tomato and bit into it, laughing.
Oh my God. This is delicious. This is so good, I could cry. You grow all this food. And basil. I love fresh basil. I miss it so much.
Yes, here. Elisabetta pinched off a sprig of basil and stuck it in the buttonhole of his jacket. As good as any flower.
Better. And these flowers, too. It smells like heaven. My God, Elisabetta. This is paradise, an oasis. You're a dream.
Elisabetta reached for him, kissing him, tasting tomato on his lips and tongue, and Sandro embraced her, kissing her back, letting go of the tomatoes, dropping them on the rooftop, and she could feel his hands and fingers as hungry as he was, moving down her body, wanting her.
Elisabetta, listen, Sandro said gently, his expression soft. Tonight, can we forget the past? Set aside everything that came before and everything that will come. I don't know what the future holds. All I can offer you is my love, my deepest love, from the very heart of me and all that I am inside. That's all I have, my darling. Can you accept that? Can you offer me yours? Can you give me tonight? Yes, yes, yes. Sandro kissed her, and Elisabetta kissed him back with full abandon. And in time, she led him to her chaise longue with its flowered cushions and pillows, tucked under the wisteria that enclosed them like a fragrant room made of flowers. And still they didn't stop kissing even as they lay down. And Sandro showed her tenderness and passion and comfort when he made love to her. And Elisabetta accepted the gift she was being offered and gave her gift in return. And afterward, they fell asleep in each other's arms, under the stars and amid the flowers and the plants and the cats.
Chapter 95. Sandro, 15th of October, 1943. Sandro woke up, holding Elisabetta. He felt a cold drizzle on his feet and realized it was beginning to rain. They were both nude on the chaise longue, and the bower of wisteria covered them. The sky was still dark, though he didn't know what time it was. The candle in the jar hadn't burned down very far. He hated to go, but his father would be home worried about Rosa.
Elisabetta?
He said softly, but she didn't stir. He disentangled himself from her, dressed quickly, and gathered her clothes. He went to the chaise longue and lifted her up, cradling her close to his chest. She murmured in her slumber, burying her face in his neck, and he carried her down the fire escape with the cats following. There was a door ajar at the first landing, and he went inside a small bedroom, lowered her onto the bed, and covered her. He glanced around her room, which was as neat and pretty as he would have expected, with a desk and a bureau against the wall. Elisabetta turned over, away from the pale light coming in through the open door, and he lingered another moment, allowing his gaze to absorb every centimeter of her, wishing he could remember every detail forever. Sandro laid her dress over the back of her chair and found a pencil on her desk to leave her a note. His gaze fell on the notebook he had left on her doorstep for her birthday. He opened it, expecting to find the pages covered with her handwriting. But instead it was blank. He wrote her a note, returned to the bed, and kissed her softly on the cheek. He could still smell the scent of wisteria that clung to her hair.
I love you, he whispered,
and Elisabetta mumbled something he couldn't understand. He left, closing the door behind him. He descended the fire escape, then reached the bottom, held on to the lowest step, and dropped to the ground. The drizzle turned to rain, and he hurried down the alley, finding a new strength. He flew through the dark streets of Trastevere in a world of his own, a paradise that life opens for young lovers, a place devoid of